The Contenders is a proud member of the Cage Club Podcast Network.
For other great shows about movies and pop culture, go visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Oh, don't you worry about it, Mr. Hart. I've been chased by swifter men than you, and I ain't been caught yet.
You gave that promotion to Bob Enright instead of me. I've got 5 years seniority over him.
I know that.
They're trying to kill me.
Why would they want to do a nasty thing like that?
I don't know. I'm not such a bad guy.
You're a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
Welcome to The Contenders, the show about the movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I'm Tobin Addington.
And I'm Aislinn Addington. And today we are talking about 9 to 5, the 1980, dare I say, classic?
I think so, yeah.
Tobin, when did you first see 9 to 5?
It is possible, although highly unlikely, but possible that at 2, when I was 2 years old when this movie came out, that I was taken to 9 to 5 in the theater with a blanket to throw over my head at bits that would have been too much for me at the time. I do not know for sure that that happened, but it certainly is a possibility given our history. But I do remember, it being sort of in the conversation. The theme song is embedded in my, like, deep in my reptilian brain. Like,
agreed.
My toes starts tapping real quick as that starts playing. I knew it growing up. Saw the Broadway musical when it debuted on Broadway with Allison Janney.
Brag.
And have not seen the movie in I would say probably about 15 or 20 years now. What about you?
I agree somewhat. I wasn't there in 1980. But I remember it being something that people talked about. We were a household that was pro all of these hilarious ladies, but I think for different reasons. There are photos of me as a toddler doing the Jane Fonda workout tape.
Oh, sure.
So that was in the house. So we knew who Jane Fonda was. She's also pivotal in On Golden Pond, which is an Addington classic.
Right, which comes out the year after this movie.
Oh, really?
It's her follow-up. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. You know how there's the Criterion Collection?
Oh, do I?
I think there should be the Addington Collection. like this strange pattern of films that are, deeply entwined in our lives. And then I remember Lily Tomlin from, is it Big Business? That's her and Bette Midler.
Yes, Bette Midler. Yeah, both in dual roles.
Yes, a twins separated at birth, kind of a Prince and the Pauper sort of.
Yes, totally.
And then of course Dolly, because we were a very big country music household and a very big, like, old-timey country music.
Right.
Like, to the point that I think our mother and grandmother kind of gave an eh to the Whitney Houston I Will Always Love You, because to them that was a Dolly Parton song.
Yes.
And so it was around in that way, but we didn't own it, interestingly, or maybe not interesting to other people. But to me, so I remember it as a movie watching when we were going to have the big sucker sale, and we were spending a lot of time all together in the kitchen watching VHSs over and over again. And also, yes, the song just, I feel like I've always known that song.
Yes, right.
It's a good one, but I don't know a lot about it. Also, have to say, still a huge fan of all these ladies. You know, currently planning my trip back to Dollywood. So, got to put that out there.
Yeah, I have my Dolly dollars, my Dolly bucks are somewhere.
Yes, burning a hole in your pocket.
I think I have a fiver.
Oh, hello. I wonder what that's become over the years.
Yeah, what inflation has done to Dollywood.
Dolly dollars appreciated. But I don't know a lot about the background to this film. So, Tobin, could you give us two bits of film history here?
I sure could. This comes at a interesting place in Jane Fonda's career. She was a very much established star at this point. She'd had Oscar nominations, if not wins, by this point. I can't remember. I'm going to look this up now. If she won for Coming Home, it's entirely possible that she did. Yes, she did. She won 2 years before. She'd won an Academy Award for Hal Ashby's Coming Home, and was had been doing a lot of very serious work. She was in a movie called The China Syndrome the year before, where she plays a reporter who's dealing with sort of like nuclear reactor issues, or like, I've never seen it, so I don't know exactly, but there's some kind of like nuclear, the secrets of like nuclear power. So anyway, she was in that kind of mode, and she is the first bit is that she had the original concept for this movie. She knew about a group of women who had an organization in New York called 9 to 5 that were trying to find ways to innovate office work, women's roles in the office, and how offices could work for more sort of gender inclusivity and parity of all kinds. And so she had this idea to make this movie, and they tried a lot of different ways, she and the producer, who I think was Bruce Gilbert, and they kept coming up against the problem of it was too, in their words, this is her words now, preachy as a drama. And so finally had the idea to make it a comedy. And the screenwriter, Patricia Resnick, her first take, it was much more dark. I think it was closer to that movie Horrible Bosses that was out in the last 10 years, where if you've seen 9 to 5, there's a sequence that's in sort of fantasies of the women all killing different ways they would get rid of their boss, Dabney Coleman. And in that original concept, that was the whole movie, was them trying to kill him and never quite being able to do it. The other bit is that this movie made more than $100 million in its initial box office run and was the second highest grossing movie of 1980. Can you guess what the only movie that made more money this year was?
E.T.
No, but you're in the wheelhouse. It is a space movie, and it is the second movie in a long-running franchise.
I don't know.
A franchise we are still experiencing today.
Oh, my God.
In space.
Oh, it's Star
Among
Trek?
The stars. Well, close.
Star
Different
Wars.
Stars.
Star Wars.
Yes, yes.
Sorry.
Empire Strikes Back is the only movie in 1980 that made more money than this movie. So when people get all up in arms about, there was when before Bridesmaids came out, it was like, ensemble female comedies cannot make money. I say one more time, fuck you, because it's been happening for a long time. So those are my two bits.
Those are great bits. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I tell you about, well, I don't have to tell you anything. Can we name the ladies in charge real quick?
Please do.
As you mentioned, writer Patricia Resnick. Actors Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton. And I have to also say there, the supporting ladies of the office were also fantastic.
Very good. Let's ding those ladies too.
Those ladies, Roz and the rest.
Yeah.
And then uncredited producer Jane Fonda.
That's a little controversial. She's not at all credited in this movie, but boy, you dig at all into the reading about this movie, and she was the sort of the producing force behind it all the way along. So I think she deserves a ding, I think.
Amen. She deserves all the dings, in my humble opinion. Tobin, because we do have some younger listeners, and in fact, in one kind of iteration of us doing this, I suggested that we have a very young person on as our guest to just see what they thought of all of this.
Yeah.
So if we have young folks who have not yet had the pleasure of watching this film, which is free on Hulu, folks.
Yes, it is.
Please tell us what this movie's about.
I'd love to. 9 to 5 is a workplace satire about three women, office newbie Jane Fonda, jaded Lily Tomlin, and sweet until you cross her, Dolly Parton, who band together to deal with their, quote, sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot of a boss, played by Dabney Coleman. After first fantasizing ways to kill him, they ultimately abduct and imprison him while they run his division in his place, and turn out to be so wildly successful at it that when he finally gets free, the powers that be ship him overseas to work his magic, freeing the women, though pointedly not offering them equal pay for equal work.
Yeah, loved that moment, didn't I? Mm-hmm. So two things. One, just because we're starting with that equal pay bit, which they do, the ladies do say they're going to work on right at the end there. This episode, you know, drops mid to late March. This year, April 2nd is Equal Pay Day.
Okay, great.
So that is the amount of time it has taken into 2019 for the average white woman to make the same amount as the average white guy. So
for doing
the same work. So there's a lot. Right. There's all kinds of, you couldn't see it in this audio platform, but there's all kinds of asterisks and things there. You're interested, please dig into it and look, because it's the common number we hear a lot is, you know, 78 cents to the dollar, depending on various identities and intersections of those identities. It can be much worse or slightly better, depending on kind of where a person sits, where their social location happens to be. So, dig into it yourselves. But we're still like very far from being where we ought to be.
Almost 40 years later, and the caveats are it could be much worse or slightly better than 78 cents on the dollar. I mean, it's I laugh only because I sort of have no other. It's that or scream. So
sure, or go to the, you know, powers that be in your particular area and demand an audit of wage parity and ask questions and do other things about it. Take that extra, the other 22 cents and devote it to causes that can help us close that gap.
There we go. Love it.
So laugh or do those things.
Or you can laugh and do those things.
Even better. Even better. The other.
I just meant right now. Sitting here.
Sure.
At this moment.
I do have a beef with this movie.
Okay. Lay it on me.
Based on the song and the film, I expected when I grew up that my job would be 9 to 5, and it is 8 to 5.
Yeah, that's a lie.
And that bothers me all the time. Dolly Parton lied to me.
Oh man! Well, finally, it all comes crashing down.
But really, you know, the film opens with the song and just the typewriter clicks and the percussion going and all that. It just makes me smile immediately. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised at, again, it's not perfect, but at how interesting and diverse the credit sequence was to this movie. Did you pick up on that?
My second note is all the leads are white, but the opening has a lot of diversity of particularly women on their way to work work, going about their day in the workplace.
Yeah, and this New York, these busy New York City streets, and shots of, you know, starts with shots of feet on the you see a lot of heels, high heels, mixed in with sort of whatever the loafers or whatever the dude shoes are, walking along the sidewalk as a way to sort of move in. Sometimes these opening sequences in movies, particularly from the 80s, I would say, are kind of throwaways. Like they don't really seem to be about, like, so like, let's just show this cool place where this movie is taking place. This one really does seem to kind of situate us in a real world of women actually working in this, you know, in this space.
Agreed. Absolutely. It sets the tone quite, as does the song. It's a great accompaniment.
As does the song.
To the song. And just immediately, they're all fantastic. All three of the leads are just masterful.
Totally. Totally dialed in, all of them. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. And playing in some cases two type, like this feels like a Lily Tomlin type, and maybe that I've just come to know more since this movie, but of her sort of world weary, been there, done that, toss off a sort of funny jaded line, but while being really, really good and in her heart, like still idealistic somewhere, you know, sort of underneath all the armor, that's really fun to see.
I agree. I was impressed. Absolutely. She is burnt out, and she's, you know, you can feel the tension of her just doing her best work, clawing her way to the middle, being passed over for opportunities, various things. And so in that, she doesn't always have, or in that early, when we're first kind of meeting her and she's doing some exposition and setting the scene, like she doesn't have a lot of compassion necessarily. Mm-hmm. But then that almost immediately there's a scene where there's speculation about Dora Lee, the Dolly Parton character, potentially having an affair with the boss. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't involve herself in that gossip at that stage. And right. I thought that was, I was like, okay. Cause I was worried. I had remembered the, what I remembered was the sort of on one side of the door, all the office people speculating right. and, you know, making things up and then passing them off as truth.
It's true.
And then yeah. on the other side of the door, seeing the extreme harassment that, Dolly Parton is, undergoing and surviving in her job. Mm-hmm. And so I was impressed because I had that like little panic of like, oh, is Lily going to be on her side or not? And really it's sort of Judy, the Jane Fonda role that is in kind of indignant at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the right word for this, that because having just been cheated on, she kind of draws her moral line in the sand that's yeah. just not okay. And then, you know, they all find out pretty quickly that it's all speculation. But let's talk about the other side of the door, that Dabney Coleman and the harassment of Dolly Parton.
Yes, let's do that.
Appalling. Obviously. And there's a, I don't know, I think Dolly plays a really interesting, I think she plays it really in an interesting way. As this is an area that I work in off yeah. and on, and I'm mm-hmm. around people talking about a lot, I hear sometimes from folks that like, oh, well, yeah, of course I'm being harassed at work, but I can take it, or I'm not like, I won't let it define me, or uh-huh. and I'm all for, I want people to be able to situate themselves in their experience. So absolutely. But I don't know. There's something about, I think she plays so nicely that complexity of she needs this job. Mm-hmm. She appears to be, at least in those first kind of encounters, she's tired of his advances. She's very clear that nothing's going to go on, but she's, mm-hmm. also in that first scenario, at least doesn't appear to be afraid necessarily.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's a lot of layers to play. And I love with this character, they show this character's home life enough that you understand kind of her relationship and maybe the rest of her life and how that influences how she's able to kind of reconcile what's going on at work, which again, we're all saying is not okay. And she says as well. But I liked the nuance because I think they could have put her in that, well, I can take it kind of category right. and gloss over the, no, it's wildly inappropriate. And I think she's able to do both. This is inappropriate. And also this is not at all what I'm interested in. And I feel happy and secure and confident in my other relationships that maybe allows me to, having that support network allows her to continue to show up at work because I don't know, regardless of what's going on at home, I don't know that I could show back up at work, like that. And also that she doesn't seem bothered by all the speculation.
Right. Until it is brought up to her face. Right. Right. Until it becomes until it becomes text and no longer sort of
right.
subtext. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Yeah. There's all three of the women's home lives are kind of interesting because they do different things, right? They show sort of different sides of this. And in all cases, I mean, in the Dolly case, like you don't get the sense that there was, in the way that there may not even be today in a lot of places, like an HR department you could go to.
Right.
You know, like here's like who is she? What is she? Who is she going to tell? Who does she have the? or she has feels as though, and I think structurally has very little power in that situation. And so she's, but when she has the most, what we would think of as in movie terms, the most traditional home life, mm-hmm. in terms of she has a stable partner. They're married, aren't they? I assume so. I guess
because the thing where she says I'm happily married, he says I am too. That's why it's perfect.
Right. That's right. That's right. So, and whereas Lily Tomlin has, how many kids does she say she has?
Four. We only ever see one.
Right. Right. And that's the one that gives them the pot. Gives her the pot. Right. Yes. That she ends up. and then you have the recently divorced Jane Fonda character who is served with her papers by her ex, like in the, you know, in scene three or right. whatever, like very early. So you're seeing different that the women at this workplace come from diverse backgrounds. This isn't a movie where it's just about a person who has is no longer being supported by a partner and so must come to work. That is one of the mm-hmm. characters that we get, and I think that the movie plays that in ways that all three feel very truthful and that sort of diversify to some degree where these characters are coming from.
Agreed. Agreed, period. Good work. Where I'm not satisfied is with Hart's wife.
Yes.
And the way that she is, you know, written into this universe and then treated in this universe, mm-hmm. Which to me is different than Roz. Like, I'll also give that, you know, the Roz character, the, you know, office kind of busybody and I don't know, suck up and whatever.
She's like the chorus. Oh, no, Roz. You're talking about Roz. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, no, not the drunk lady.
Right.
But the one that'll the tattletale.
Second in command, yeah. Tattletale, yeah.
Which also, like, I'll give her that's her mechanism to survive and or get ahead in that business environment that Hart's created, right? I mean, sure. She's a product of that environment. And so I'll... I have empathy for her, even though she is a saboteur in the for our heroes. Like, I think that's also sure. That's another way that she could be at work. She could be the person who is no nonsense and going to follow to the letter what the boss says and tell the boss what's going on. Okay, that's fine if that's who she wants to be, or that's how where she is in this time and place. But the Hart's wife character, I just feel like they're unkind when they talk about her. And then her obliviousness she just has kind of lack of anything real to me. Like I can mm-hmm. see all the rest as full-fledged humans. And I just see a caricature there. And so that is disappointing. And I wanted to point it out, but
mm-hmm. yeah, no, it's true. The movie does not offer her. Both of those characters does not offer them the same dignity that it gives to these other, especially Ooh, these
that's
the
a
three
good way to say it.
Women.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. They're sort of just, both of them are just punchlines, mm-hmm. which is too bad.
It's too bad. I noticed pretty early on Dolly Parton's fingernails. That's why we have nails like that now. It's not Instagram. It's Dolly Parton in 1980.
I love it.
Okay. Intense. And I'm all for it. Do whatever you want to do. But those are harsh. I also wrote down toward the beginning that, of course, Hart steals Violet's idea. She comes to him with an idea and he says, no, we can't do it. It's too expensive. And then the next thing you know, the big boss is congratulating Hart in front of everybody for his amazing idea. And I just wrote down, yeah, still a thing all the time, constantly happening.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And not always exactly. in that particular, like it's not... It doesn't have to be a gendered issue, but it very, very often is.
I remember I've had a lot of friends who've worked in offices to varying degrees of corporateness, maybe is the way to say that, in New York. And the experience I remember mostly is I mostly remember hearing women talk about this, but you're right. People of all different genders having this issue where someone would take their or that they were expected to do that work mm-hmm. and then allow their boss to take credit. Right. Even not like it was a slippery thing where they were like it is in this movie where he's clearly said no and then stolen the idea and kept taking credit for it, but rather it's just the job of the least highly paid, mm-hmm. least respected people in the yeah. office to generate work and ideas that then they're sort of the people who are hiring them will take credit for it. Then that's just understood to be part of the process. Yeah. That is, I always found that maybe because I come from sort of from a field where intellectual property is held a little bit higher. Not which is not to say that the movie business is at all golden here, but in terms of like my peers who are writers, like we generate our ideas and write them, right. and the idea that someone else would do that, give to someone else to take to show as their idea is kind of goes against a very sort of deep seated. Sure.
There are pockets, right? Ghostwriting.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Oh, yeah. Well, but in general, yeah. I do not mean that. There's that systematically, it is not an issue. But in terms of, I found when these people would tell me their stories, I would think. And they would tell it to me, not like, can you believe this thing is happening? But, oh yeah, this happens. I'm like, that mm-hmm. happens? Like, yeah, that seems not to be the system that we should have, which, is our refrain here on the show.
It reminds me of a scene that's always stayed with me from Mad Men. And full disclosure, I didn't make it all the way through that saga. But somewhere in the middle, there's, I think... and maybe the company got an award for a particular mm-hmm. campaign, and Elizabeth Moss's character, Peggy, who is working at that point on the creative side, is upset that her name wasn't on the award or something. And she was just like, but I did all this work. This is my thing. And Don Draper says, yeah, that's what the money was right. for. Like, you right. work here,
right.
Which is, and I've used that to be honest here in this safe space that we're in. I've used that both ways, right? I could see that.
Sure, sure.
I can lean to this side of she should have gotten credit for being on the team and for originating the idea, or someone should have mentioned it, or they should have come to her and said, hey, thank you for this. Because of what your contribution, the company got this award or whatever. But then also on the other side, having been a research assistant on multiple large, million-dollar projects, mm-hmm. I do my piece, my name's not on it, that's what the money was for.
Right. Yeah, yeah, true. That's so, true. That's true. Yeah.
Always think about that. But there's a lot of women versus girl early on, too. I raised my glass to that as I'm constantly... saying women when someone says girl.
Well, you were in work in particular high offenders in higher education. I have noticed.
Yes. Very true.
Undoubtedly in other sort of things as well. But when a lot of the people who are around you are young, I find that people still lean mm-hmm. into that word at times when it's not been particularly apt for about 15 or 20 years.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also just that we don't do the same. Like if we were saying,
yes, right.
College, the boys basketball team in college.
Right.
Right. But we don't, we say the men's team. So if we were, infantilizing everyone, great. but we're not. Mm-hmm. I have a question, Tobin.
Ooh.
You mentioned the Lily Tomlin's son that gives her a joint.
Yeah.
A marijuana cigarette, as they say, in yes. the bar. And then they all smoke it, and they're all smoking it on camera and then have the fantasies of killing the boss and what have you. But was that controversial?
No.
At the time that these three – it wasn't that Jane Fonda was
no
smoking pot in a movie?
I mean, I'm sure part of it is a joke. There's like a wink to that by 1980. I mean, her brother, Henry Fonda. No. Her brother, Peter Fonda. Her father was Henry Fonda. Her brother, Peter Fonda, was, you know, it's like a big staple. Well, they both were of sort of youth culture, counterculture in the 1960s. But looking particularly at Easy Rider, which was 1969, 68, I think, which is, you know, completely drug laced and, you know, mm-hmm. and is sometimes credited with sort of introducing cocaine to the American market because of that movie in particular, that it was, I think it would read as transgressive, you know, but not at all shocking, not by 1980. Huh? I mean, remember how close we are to 16, Breakfast Club, right? Like the pot scene in Breakfast Club, which is within 6-7 years of this movie.
Yes, but keep in mind that I have seen
the TV edit
200 times, the TV edit, yes, where they don't show that.
You and me both.
So that's not a huge component of my memory of that film.
Yeah.
It does make some things make more sense in the later scenes in that movie. I was just curious. I get when you read the Fondas in that light, I guess I was thinking maybe more Dolly Parton.
Maybe so. This is, of course, Dolly Parton's first movie. Like, this is her first movie role.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I love it. She's so cute.
She is so good in this movie.
She's so good. Can I trade it and say she's so good instead of saying she's so cute?
I know what you mean. Like the character that she's playing.
She's charming.
Yeah, exactly. And she begins as the kind of if you were to make the bad 80s poster where they each get their own poster, she's the cute one. Like, that's, you know, you have the serious one, the cute one, the new one.
Well, yeah.
Jane
Fonda stares at her chest.
Yes, in their first meeting. Yes.
In that first scene, and then self-consciously touches her own. So,
and there's lots of description, you know, people talking about how attractive she is in the movie, you know, they're leaning into a type that then she gets to sort of flesh out in interesting ways and give lie to our expectation that she's going to be ditzy, I think is the stereotype.
Right, exactly.
So I think you're perfectly within your rights to say that she's cute, because that's just objectively true. And then what she does with that, what the movie does with that is even more interesting.
Yeah. I think my favorite moment was much later. So, okay. There's something I didn't remember.
Yeah.
I remembered the rat poison. I didn't remember that. Then that led to this wild corpse chase.
Yes.
Where they steal a corpse that they think is him from the hospital, and it's not. And then they have to return it, and then they're stopped by the police. Like, that whole thing, I just didn't remember that. And I think because it's, in my humble opinion, like, kind of the weakest.
Yes, for sure.
Section of it, that so that's when I think of 9 to 5, that is not what I think of. So I guess I expected them to abduct Dabney Coleman much earlier, because I had forgotten about that whole thing. I was an hour in and they still hadn't got him. And so anyway, but when much later, when after they've sort of accidentally abducted him, but then they, speaking of leaning in, they go for it.
Yeah,
there's at some point where Dolly just says, like, well, let's just get some roustabouts and have him kick his ass. And it was just like, so she was sincere, and it felt like she knew who she would call.
Yes, exactly.
And like she suddenly just went country on him, in a way, like, oh yeah, well, that absolutely makes sense to me too. Let's just do that. And I laughed so hard. I think it was my favorite part.
I agree with you that whole section of the movie is the weakest. I wasn't bored by it, but I was finding it sort of tangential to the story. It felt like a bunch of gags thrown in rather than anything having to do with the story. And I had forgotten it as well. It's not a thing I remembered. And I would have been happy if they had cut that part like in half. I think that would have been fine.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about their?
It was still fun to watch them.
But. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're delightful. All of them in the front together in the car, like talking to the cop. Like that's mm-hmm. a funny bit. I don't begrudge each little bit of it, but it just does go on for a while. Do you have a favorite of the fantasies? So the three, they get together and they're at, when one of the women has lost their job because they've been talking about how much they make and wondering how much Dabney Coleman makes, that woman loses her job and the three of them leave the office. And before they smoke the pot, they're starting to have fantasies of what they would do to kill Dabney. What did you think of those bits? And do you have one that you like the best?
I mean, I rolled my eyes a little bit. Because that's just not my a fantasy sequence is not my favorite part of any movie generally. However, what I loved about it is getting a sense of each of their imaginations and kind of each of their particular beefs with him, and you know how. Because I do, I am a person who avoids conflict, but has arguments and fights with people in my head all the time. Like, if we were going to have this argument, here's how, you know, I'd practice it in my mind.
And then you come on this podcast and have real arguments with me.
Exactly. And that's why I'm so good at them. I practice. Yeah. But so I appreciated that your mind wandering to this absurd place and that revenge. Also, as you know well, I understand this is complex and I'm not looking at it in the most complex way. I love a lady's fantasy, like revenge fantasy, right? So Snapped Sundays, when there's a Snapped marathon on Lifetime, I am in. Like, all day I will keep that on and just wander in and out and watch different ladies kill their husbands. The Dixie Chicks.
Yes, Goodbye Earl. Yeah.
As you know, I was a huge fan of. So, again, I don't condone violence. It's not right. It's not okay. But there's something about, and I think it's because of the you know, in whatever example you want to choose, because of those circumstances and the lack of agency and lack of opportunity, that then the pendulum swings the other way. And so I think that's what I have empathy for is the pendulum part of it. but my favorite, none of that was the answer to your question. Probably Dolly, just because it was so silly.
Yeah. I
don't know. What was your favorite?
My favorite was Dolly's, not the part where she's like roping him and stuff, when she is doing to him, she basically is given his role. So they're in his office and she's doing all the stuff to him that he does to her, talking about his butt and his package and his like total objectification and sort of, you know, and harassment of him in a way it's not funny that, I mean, it's funny because she's funny and their timing is so good and it's a funny scene, but it also is, I think, the movie at its most, it gives me a hint of what that dark version might have been, their original conception, where you see what, you know, the audience is put in a different space in terms of identification in those scenes. Whereas I think some audience members could watch the earlier scene where she is being harassed and it's just more funny. And then this happens and I'm thinking some audiences might say, oh God, this is wildly inappropriate. Do you know what I mean? In a way that it was just as inappropriate before, but may not register in the same way in 1980. Maybe I'm giving people not enough credit, but I think that's part of the,
no, that's a good point, because it is in that first time they have an exchange in reality, and you know his chair is broken. She comes in and he's sort of upside down, and at that point I still wasn't sure if she was ditzy or not. You know, he moves things on the desk so that she'll have to bend over and pick something up. Which, as he was doing that, I was like, that is disgusting. But there is. Maybe if it's from his point of view, it's funny, but like it is it appears to be a humorous scene in some ways. That I think, if somebody thought that was funny, then hopefully seeing the Dolly version would put into perspective how inappropriate it is. And we see that other times, right? Wasn't it not that I'm a huge proponent of either of these people, but I feel like Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart did some sort of press thing where Kristen Stewart asked him the types of questions she's asked so often.
That sounds right.
Like, of what kind of underwear do you have to wear with that?
Right.
Or how do you pee in that? Or is this the kind of makeup you wear at home? Or like whatever, just kind of things that I just have nothing to do with the art.
Right. And it have more to do with sort of with the titillation about people's bodies and things like that. Yeah. I think that there's something about there's a lot of scholarship about mainstream film in particular and the characters who we are so often asked to identify with that the audience sort of assumes that this, you know, that the white guy is the person you're going to identify with. The story is going to be told from that point of view, which is why there are times in history where the flipping of, in this case, of their genders in this moment, makes that more, that scene becomes then more interesting because we are suddenly the relief, seeing it in relief demonstrates how often we see that the reverse scene that in general, people may not be thinking about it in the same way. And I think that was the one of those that I went, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then the others were just sort of goofy a little bit, you know?
I guess, I don't love it, but I sort of liked, I can appreciate the fantasy sequences because I think that's part of what helps us get from Jane Fonda of the beginning of the movie to Jane Fonda in the end. Because, and as an uncredited producer, she, whether or not, you know, she's anyone's favorite or that, I feel like she has the most kind of perceptible arc of, she starts out, it's her first day. She's never been in a corporate environment. Other people comment, not really to her, but just comment, she's not really dressed for it. She's appears to be a little bit meek
and unsure
and that. And then by the time that she's in Hart's house, her ex-husband shows up and Hart's trying to get him, has filed away at the leather restraints. And she's managing both of those situations and in charge of both of them and like subdues in different way both of these men and then says, you know, and tells her husband off in a way that it appears she hasn't done. Yet or ever, that then leads to that final, the long office scene when Hart's back at the office and just before he can call the police, the real, real big boss, the Colonel Sanders comes in and the women are showing all the work that Hart has done that he hasn't done any of to change things in the office. And I didn't remember the Brazil thing and how they were going to get Hart to go away. So at that first, when I was first starting to watch it, I was like, oh my gosh, is he going to take credit for all this too? But knowing that it kind of turns out okay that way, it's fun to watch kind of the knowing looks and I don't know, just the confidence that all three of them have in look at these amazing things that we've done and that work so well. Like, it's not just that they got stuff done without him, but they've made these improvements that help the lives of everyone. And I don't know that the Jane Fonda at the beginning of the movie could have done that.
Yeah. I love that piggybacking on that, the idea that none of them could have done it alone is another sort of cool thing is that you see them as such a team. Well, actually pretty early. Like I'm buying them. Maybe again, I'm not seeing this with fresh eyes at all, but I'm buying them as a team pretty early, but and I think that we don't fully understand how much they have. I mean, we do see in montage that they are changing the office, but some of the things that we see are sort of, which makes sense. In a montage, you're going to see the more superficial things. And I don't mean superficial as not important, but having flowers at your desk, like some things that you can sort of see visually that may be a little on a smaller scale. And then you understand how much more productive the office is because they have done these, because they've made some real substantive changes that you can't as easily see that you're like, oh wow, they've accomplished so much in like the 2 weeks or whatever that they've had him locked up.
Yeah. It is something of a feel good moment right there at the end. And, but also things that what was then frustrating was thinking about, okay, 1980, and so many of the things that are still not standard. Right.
Exactly.
Places that could or should be. And I'm not saying every office has to have a daycare, but the flexibility of coming in and out when it works best for you, so that you can do your best work, is just makes sense.
Yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
And does not make sense to other people.
And you know, there's a recent study, I can't remember where it was from, but not too long ago, that had to do with the idea of free to somewhere between free and affordable universal childcare, both for you know, preschoolers and for kids after school, and on a purely economic argument, it makes so much sense. Like it would increase productivity, even if the sort of human side of it was not important to you, and you were just looking at the bottom line. But
right.
That alone would sort of more than pay for, I don't remember what, some giant thing that we mm-hmm. can't afford to do right now that we would be able to if we just took care of kids, so people could have the flexibility to work as they needed to and not have to. So anyway, there's a depressing thing to the end of this movie that's not depressing, maybe not the right word, but I do have that a little bit of a crestfallen feeling, as exciting as it is at the end that they've sort of accomplished this in this way, that not only is it called out that they are not going to be paid equally, but also that you could take the same laundry list of things and apply it, you know, to most workplaces and find that it's not there. And I think that's
right.
You know, that sucks. That really sucks.
It does suck. It does. But still a fun movie.
Yeah, in the end, did you enjoy the experience of watching this movie, or was it more anthropological?
I did enjoy it, for sure. I think, again, that the particularly the three women, and we can talk about Dabney Coleman a little bit on his own in a second, but they're just so dynamic. They're all three fantastic characters. They're very different, but kind of like you said, Tobin, I believed them as a team pretty early on. Once they all find themselves at the bar together and kind of get through some of the office stuff that, because I have in my notes that the way that Hart and Roz, honestly, run the office pits people against each other.
Right.
And particularly pits all these women against each other. And that it's this atmosphere of telling on each other. And it just seems like they're not going to get the best out of people because they're just looking for the worst in people.
Right.
Or expecting the worst in people. So the three performances are just, you know, outstanding. So for that, I mean, I will watch Lily Tomlin do anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how I have made it so far in Grace and Frankie. So for me, the Lily Tomlin was a very kind of against type, because what I've seen her most recently is like super flowy, let your hair down, relaxing,
like bohemian. Yeah.
Bohemian in the and for the record, I did enjoy most of the first seasons of that program. It's sort of fallen off for me, but that's a different podcast.
Mom just turned off the podcast right there.
Oh, she and I have talked about it. Okay. And just for the record, for others listening of that age group, it's not about the children wanting to put them in the home. It's about them not listening to their children's legitimate concerns. But in any case.
Hint, hint.
No. No. But so I feel like, you know, the Jane Fonda in that is much more, she's sort of playing a Jane Fonda character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But so this was, you know, it was fun to see this as well. It's a little bit more in line with what I expect from her, but just great to see. I mean, they carry this whole movie. However, they have to have this nemesis. So let's talk about Dabney Coleman just for a minute and how that worked. It's odd to me because I don't think of him as someone in my life. But if you look at, there's a few pivotal films mm-hmm. from back in the day that star that man. And so he's kind of in my life.
Should we name some of those?
Well, he's in it on Golden Pond, is he not?
Yes, he is. Yes,
he
is.
Play her.
He does. Partner? He does. Yes. Yes. Like, literally, they're shooting at that movie as this one's coming out. It's crazy. So they end up together.
Right. In the end. And then Cloak and Dagger, right?
Cloak and Dagger. Shout out to Nick Jenkins, the only other person. Well, and Rob, the only other people I know who know this movie. Other than us, who know it by heart. Cloak and Dagger. And then War Games, too, which may have been I probably watched that more than you did. But he's in War Games, too.
What did you think of his portrayal of a terrible boss?
I think the thing that makes him work so well here is that he is charming. Mm. I think there is a, he's like, there's goofball quality to him. He is his cruelty to me reads as maybe even more sinister because he's half befuddled, you know, like he's a doofus. And I think that one of the things that's so smart about this movie is that the boss is, they're getting at something that feels very true, which is like mediocrity gets promoted up until it lodges somewhere where it then just sort of like stews. And I think that that's him. I think he is like not the actor, but the character is an extraordinarily mediocre worker, it seems to me, and is probably getting worse as he goes along, and is only ostensibly only here because he could tell a joke, you know, and will kiss up to the right people, and has a smile, and is probably not a bad salesman, and has sort of then sort of stuck here. And I may be alone in finding him charming, but I think when he smiles, like there's something in that smile that reads as. Oh, I don't know. What I'm saying is you could have put somebody in there in this role who's just sort of pure, mean. And I think that having somebody who's a little like who's somebody who's a, you know, a teddy bear, who is like a cruel teddy bear is both more interesting and I think that sort of plays this other side of the character, that makes him a good match for this role. What about you? What did you think?
Charming certainly is not the word I would use.
I could tell when I said it, you're like, oh God. Okay.
I mean, you're absolutely right in that he can network in this, you know, this particular corporate system that he's a part of. He has done well. Lily Tomlin says her back is tired from everyone leapfrogging past her because she trained him. And I think we know that it's, you know, can be easier depending on the situation, but you know, for men there's, you know, glass escalator, glass ceiling, all that.
Right.
So I can see him as benefiting from those privileges. And I get twinkle in his eye. Maybe he must have been good at one step in the ladder, but I don't know. I just can't. Charming is not the word.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to make sure I'm clear. I don't think that Franklin is charming. I think Dabney Coleman is charming.
Sure. I feel like you're doubling back a little bit because you talked about him being able to get along with the people and tell a joke and all that in order to succeed. And I think, you know, I would agree likely he has to have something in order to not a lot, but you know, something to get him there. I also think he is great at stealing other people's ideas and taking credit where he can. And, you know, I mean, I think he's slick and that's how he's gotten to where he is. I don't think it's because of charm. I think he does a very good job of playing a believably sleazy guy who, you know, based on his people skills has been able to succeed.
Mm.
Would you like to play a game?
I would love to play a game.
Excellent.
It'd be funny if sometime I said no.
It would. I'd be like, okay, I'm done. This game is called Best Pants Suited.
Okay.
I will give you a scenario, and you will tell me which character, Violet, Judy, Dora Lee, you would prefer to be in the scenario with.
Okay. Okay.
And the scenarios are based on other films that we've done. So, for example, who would you rather take with you to the front lines of World War One, a la Wonder Woman?
Wonder Woman. Oh, Violet or Dora Lee?
Judy or Dora Lee.
Okay, I'm going to say Dora Lee because she knows how to handle a weapon.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer.
Each have, I think, their strong suits, but I would, what about you? Who would you take to the front lines of war, to the trenches of World War One?
I was going to take Violet. So I feel like she is the most strategic, maybe, and would be good at making plans and kind good of call. Executing a complex thing there. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Next up. Who would you rather have on your team to pull off a major heist, a la Ocean's 8? Which of these three characters would you add to the Ocean's 8 team?
Oh, Violet, for sure. I would love to see Lily Tomlin on the Ocean's, in Ocean's 9. Oh, gosh, oh my God, that would be so good.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. Let's get to Twitter and tell the powers that be. You tell Sandy Bullock she needs Lily Tomlin. That'd be awesome.
Oh my God.
Like you said with the previous question, any of them, are going to have strengths. I think I would take Judy because, I think she is maybe the most believable at playing a kind of meeker, subdued, unassuming. I think she, because she sort of starts off that, that's a component of her personality. I think she could play that in a way to get her into a room or close to a target or something. So I'll say Judy for that.
Nice. Nice. Yeah.
Who would you want to work a whole day at the pie diner with? Who would be your waitress companion?
Oh boy. I just think, okay, my initial instinct is to say Dora Lee because I think because it's unfair, but I sort of associate down home and pies, and I feel like she could do a good job. But I think I would want to work with Judy. I think that it would working in a pie diner would give you enough time to really get to know Judy. It feels like Judy is at the start of the movie anyway is a little as you say it said before, kind of unsure of herself and sort of held back a little bit. And I think that underneath that, there's clearly this amazing, fun, funny woman under there. And so it would be fun to have enough time to sort of get to know her better. So I would say Judy. Are you Dora Lee? Is that your pick?
100% Dora Lee. But I think that's just because I would love to like watch her engage with customers. I think that would be super fun. I would love to hear her stories that she would tell, and if she would sing at the diner. And I mean, I thought it was funny the way in the closing credits, you know, you find out what they all do next. And Dora Lee, you know, leaves the company to be a country and western singer. Just like, okay, yes, of course. Yes. Why not?
Yeah.
Who of these three would you want on your roller derby team?
Violet.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, Dora Lee would be great too, but Violet, for the same reasons you would want her on the battlefield, I think the strategy she'd be, and there, she would like take no guff, right? Like, among the team disputes or whatever, like she'd keep things in order.
Yeah, I agree. I think Violet would be a great asset to a roller derby team. Okay. Who would you rather work together with to stop a psycho killer who is killing women and stalking you from copycat?
So you're putting me in the Sigourney Weaver role and who yes, would be the Holly Hunter?
Who is your Holly Hunter?
Oh my God, my Holly Hunter is, that's great. gosh, you know, ideally all three, because I think it would really,
right?
I think that would be the best option, them all working together with their strong suits. And Dora Lee can take them out at the end with a shot.
I hadn't thought of it that way till you said it, but I think having them as a team is probably the only way to triumph there.
And it's like the A team, but
I was gonna say, and potentially, you know, their first plan would not be the plan that worked, but they would find a plan that worked.
right.
If they can themselves out of getting pulled over with a corpse in the back, they could they could probably keep you from getting killed that way. And then finally, who would you have join you for a Thanksgiving with your dysfunctional family?
Okay, so if you took Dora Lee, she would get along with everybody and like have everybody singing along at the table by the end of the night. If you took Violet, she would that could be fun. Having Dora Lee could be fun. If you had Violet, that could be fun because she would not like she would call it out kind of halfway through dinner. She'd start saying, "Are you kidding me?" And you know, and speak truth to those moments. But I think if I were being true to my personality, I think Judy would probably be the person I would go to who would be polite and get along, and then afterwards we could talk to one another and say, "Can you believe how crazy that was?"
Oh, interesting. See, I was thinking I wouldn't bring Judy because I would want someone who is going to stick up for me no matter what, and I feel like Judy is going to kind of, you know, based on her internal compass, which is fantastic, she's going to, say what she believes to be fair or, you know what I mean? Like she's going to go for the larger right or wrong. Right. And I think that's not what I want at that. I want someone who's just going to have my back.
Yes. Yes.
And so, I sort of think Violet for me would be that if we came in as a team, she's going to defend me to the end, even if the larger right or wrong is not in line with it.
So here's what I think is funny about that is that you would be my Violet. Like you would operate as a Violet in that situation and I would operate as a Judy in that situation.
100%.
So who's our Dora Lee?
Oh gosh.
I guess one of the dogs when we were kids. Oh no, yeah. Who?
Nelia.
Oh yes. There you go. Yes.
She's just glad to be there. She's gonna bring some great food.
Yep.
You know, she's gonna be cutting up stuff in the kitchen and just say, "Isn't it great? We're all here."
Yep. And then also be able to say later, like, "That was really crazy, y'all."
Yes.
You know, and then, but not in any kind of judgmental way, which is the key to that Dora Lee character.
With a smile.
Yeah. Good call. Absolutely. Yes. So that means that Nelia is my Oprah and our Dolly Parton.
Yes. 100%.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Join us next week for the game. Who's Nelia? Excellent. Thank you for playing Best Pants Suited.
Oh, I love that game. Well done.
Thank you. All right. We've come to the end here. It's time for our closing thoughts. This is the moment where we give a summation of whether we think this is progressive or regressive. Is this a step forward or a step back for fearless women in front of and behind the camera? Tobin?
So this is not perfect. It's not. I don't enjoy this movie as much as I liked our last week, Mama Addington's favorite movies, Thelma and Louise, last episode. But I do really enjoy a lot of this movie. And I do think that beyond that, the fact that Jane Fonda was such a power behind the scenes, I think you can feel that it had a woman writer, and giving these three women the dignity that they have in the performances that they have, and sort of the packaging the whole thing with this Dolly Parton song. And I think that for all the parts, the weaker parts of the movie, I think that it's definitely a step forward. I would say this is progressive. What about you?
Absolutely. I agree. Like I said, I don't think all the women are given that that same kind of dignity and well-roundedness. That's okay. It can't be a 7-hour movie where we know everything about everyone. But the leads are dynamic. And for me, the issues that they bring up, that this movie is about workplace inequality and is also funny and was also successful.
Right.
I think is fantastic. It, you know, I think of the, you know, ads that I would see this fall for the Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie that came out in the winter, and how just whether or not the movie was going to be great, I was so glad that it was there. Mm-hmm. I wonder, even though this is a comedy, how that might have made people feel who were dealing with some of those issues to see, oh, wow, this is like on the big screen. They're talking about the concerns that I have at work every day. Mm-hmm. And giving them kind of space to explore that. And then also I do love a good revenge fantasy. So, I agree. I think it's clear that this was written and influenced by women's experience. And I think that's great, especially if you take into account the time period, but also just great. So I will take it progressive. And also I would say, please don't reboot it.
Well, they're going to.
You know what I mean? But, of course.
But they're all three are going to be in it, and Rashida Jones is writing it.
Okay. I will make peace with that.
I mean, I think and Patricia Resnick is involved. So the original writer,
okay,
and Rashida Jones and the three, and they're going to do it at Netflix.
We'll have to talk about that when it comes out.
I think we will have to. I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay, good. As long as one of us is.
Yes. That's kind of my role, is to be the cautiously optimistic one.
Absolutely. What's next, Tobin?
Next up for us, we are going to do the movie that was voted on by our voting members, our voting level Patreon members. We're going to do Sofia Coppola's Lost in Translation. On that episode will come out on April 2nd. So come back here and hear our thoughts about Lost in Translation.
That episode comes out on Equal Pay Day?
Oh, as a matter of fact, that episode comes out on Equal Pay Day. Yes. So we'll have to make note of that on that episode, even though we'll be recording it ahead of time. Yeah, cool.
Awesome. We'll do. It's the magic of editing.
So in that episode, we will both get paid the same amount. which is actually, we've been paid the same amount the entire time, which is nothing. So,
which is nothing. But yes, thank you. I appreciate it. So generous.
We will continue to pay ourselves nothing on April 2nd in honor of Eagle Pay. Yeah. Aislinn, first of all, do you still want to be found online? And if so, where? And tell us how is next up for your other show.
Great. Thank you. So yes, I'm still vaguely around at SassyNerdMT on Twitter. I'm not good at it. It's fine. But what I'm excited about, and thanks for this opportunity, is to talk about my short series podcast, Why Aren't We All? There's one episode out now. It's Why Aren't We All Vegan?
Yay.
And it's fun and interesting. These are meant to be just short introductory conversations to a topic. I'm not going to do all the research for you. I don't have time. But I talked to someone who has a practice, a belief, a life plan that makes things a little bit easier for them. And we talk about what it might be like if everyone followed that example. So Why Aren't We All Vegan is out now. And then coming the day before Lost in Translation will be the second episode. And I'm not going to disclose what it is. You'll have to listen to find out. Why Aren't We All? You can also catch up with the show on WAWA_pod. Why Aren't We All? Wawa Pod. on Twitter, which I am super bad at, but that has to do with my inability to switch back and forth from Twitter accounts. So I'll get some tech help and be better at it by the time we talk to you again on April 2nd. Tobin,
Find me on Twitter at Tobin Addington, and you can find us on Twitter at Contenders_pod or on Patreon at thecontenderspod.com. Special thanks to our members who've joined at the marquee level or above, Sean Flynn and Jeff Addington. Become a member today, connect with other listeners, and support our show. And coming soon, sometime soon, we'll have our first bonus mini-pod. Every time we get 10 new members at any level on our Patreon community, we will record a bonus mini-episode on some subject. Maybe a movie, it may be something that the Oscars, or, you know, who knows what, some sort of other subject. And our first one, since we have 10 currently, 10 members, we are going to record an episode with special guest Joe Bolenbaugh on the movie Hope Floats. So we'll get to that here. We'll get that in your ears sometime in the next little while.
We here at The Contenders are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. You can explore all their great shows at cageclub.me. And you can keep tabs on all the Cage Club happenings on Twitter at Cage Club Pod. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'm Aislinn Addington.
I am Tobin Addington, and we'll see you next time on The Contenders.
I understand what you're saying.
You just said, I don't think it's his charm. And I'm saying it's not his charm. It's Dabney Coleman's charm. Is what I'm crediting.
Great. I don't know what you want from me.